This podcast is presented by Hannover Messe, your leading event for industrial AI.
Hi there, and welcome to a new episode of the Industrial AI podcast. My name is Peter Seeberg, and my guest today is Xiaopeng Li from Microsoft. Xiaopeng and I are going to talk about Gen AI adoption or the adoption of generative AI. Hello, Xiaopeng.
Hey, good to be here.
Good to have you on the show, Xiaopeng. Let's start with you introducing yourself to our Industrial AI podcast listeners, please.
Sure. So Xiaopeng is my name. I work for Microsoft. I've been in the AI space for quite some years now. For the past 3 years, I'm leading the AI business for Microsoft across the Western European market. It is a market where a lot of innovation and a lot of pioneering work are happening. So incredibly proud of what we have been doing, you know, in the AI space with our customers and partners, and looking forward to sharing more in the coming episode.
Okay. Yeah, we'll certainly do that. Interesting that you say so. An area where a lot of things are happening, which maybe not always we ourselves are certain of. But yeah, I'm sure we'll come to that at some point in time. When I looked at your profile, and I think you caught that as well, that you and I actually studied at the same university in Delft, right?
Absolutely. It's a tough one, right? I mean, I remember spending a lot of time, maybe too many hours in a laboratory. not a laboratory, I mean, in a library, studying for the exams, etc. But, you know, you laid a good foundation for my work today.
You were there a little bit later than I was. But then again, I don't know. I haven't been there for quite some time. I assume that maybe at least the village, the city, Delft, and its environments has been probably changed a little bit. But I can very well imagine the atmosphere in which you have been studying there. So, no need to introduce your company. I may assume that, you know, close to 100% of our listeners, if not exactly 100% of our listeners, have heard about your company, Microsoft. So, instead, maybe you can tell us a little bit about the area, maybe department, where it is that you're based from. You already said a little bit, and do maybe a little bit of a quick introduction on, you know, the things that that you do.
Yeah, sure, absolutely. So I'm personally based in Oslo, Norway. You know, right now it's winter wonderland, and I work in a European organization, so the European headquarters. So that means I work with colleagues across the Europe, and they're, you know, distributed. You know, from London to Madrid, you know, to Vienna, etc. So my discipline or my domain within Microsoft is the go-to-market function. If you think about, you know, what Microsoft does or what most software companies, you know, do, it's essentially two buckets of things. The first bucket would be, you know, developing the products, right? That's everything from, you know, understanding the user needs to design, to development, you know, infusing AI, data science, whatever. And then the second part is really to bring the products to the market, right? And that's everything from, you know, thinking about how to maybe land the value proposition to different industries, to different segments, to different personas through events, content, campaign, but also how you do sales, right? Everything from, you know, the conversation with executives and the conversation with the key decision makers and even the hands-on professionals. And also, you know, in terms of how you deliver your product and services to the customer in what we call the customer success stage of our business. And the last piece is really also working alongside of our whole partner ecosystem. On one hand, enabling them on our latest product innovations so they understand how to, you know, make the best out of them. On the other hand, you know, also jointly go to market with them, right? So that we bring products together with their services to serve our joint customers.
Very good. Sounds a little bit like what I've been doing during the 90s for a company called Intel. And what I assume we were doing at that time for Intel was very interestingly, in that maybe there's a stronger overlap, because in that case, it was about selling, you know, a piece of hardware like a chip, you know, Intel Inside. And we couldn't, although it was the Intel Insight, we had to, you know, make people believe, you know, convince people why they would need to buy a PC notebook with Intel Insight. And we would go through software, you know, it's like, why would you need it? We don't want to go too much in detail. And you do the go-to-market for whatever is AI-based products for Microsoft or...
Yes, I'm leading the AI go-to-market strategy for Western Europe. My primary focus is on Azure AI. So that's our cloud platform, right? I mean, Azure is our cloud platform. And the vast majority of our AI platform services are inside Azure. But what has happened during 2023 is that we have now also infused the AI into pretty much, you know, every product and services we offer from Microsoft.
I was going to say, right?
Yeah.
Now, everything is AI, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, personal opinion, I feel like, you know, we are sort of, you know, transforming from a cloud company into an AI company, if I dare to say so. And my point is that in our cloud infrastructure, you have AI infused on the platform layer. We offer a lot of AI platform services and tools for developers and data scientists, machine learning engineers. And then on the software layer, we also have different off-the-shelf products, which are, you know, enhanced and infused with AI and which are, you know, ready to use, like all the co-pilots, right? We've been launching, you know, co-pilots almost every month in 2023. And most of them are powered by, you know, large language models and other advanced AI technologies.
Very good. Just out of modesty, I believe you had suggested that we should be not spending too much time on you as a company, as Microsoft. And that mm-hmm. is okay. And also as a message to the listeners for here, this is not going to be a sales talk by Chao Peng for, you know, buying Microsoft products. That's not the idea. We're gonna learn from Chao Peng and gonna ask him, you know, what it is that he has seen, that he is seeing as part of his job being in the market. So let's start maybe with a specific question. If you hear people say that ChatGPT is the iPhone moment for AI, how would you react to that?
So, you know, I have sort of mixed sentiments around this comment, right? I think, you know, when ChatGPT first came out, you know, in November, and then, you know, he has really propelled a lot of excitement and discussions and momentum in the market, especially the beginning of 2023. And in my head, you know, it's a killer application, right? I mean, before ChatGPT, there has already been years of research on transformers and, you know, large language models, especially in academia or in more closed doors of research labs. But ChatGPT is really the application which brought a large language model and wrapped that into a simple interface and make that accessible to anyone, right? So I think that's the beauty of ChatGPT as a killer application. But if you look at the iPhone, it's really an ecosystem because, you know, it's not only the hardware itself, it's the app store, it's the entire operating ecosystem. So that's why, you know, at first I was a bit skeptical when people talk about, you know, ChatGPT, it's the iPhone moment for AI. Maybe from a, you know, hype democratization point of view, yes, but not necessarily from an ecosystem point of view. But that's changing, right? Because 2 months ago or 3 months ago, I mean, OpenAI, they announced the GPT store. I think they just made that available.
They did, right? Yes, a day or two ago, yeah.
Exactly. So now it's different because they're actually creating an ecosystem. And I think, you know, they have this huge ambition to actually maybe turn the GPT store into a new type of, you know, ecosystem where everyone can build new GPTs. And there are like mini applications within ChatGPT, right? More specialized and for specific tasks. And then you can even, you know, monetize on that. So I think that adds the ecosystem of flavor, you know, on ChatGPT. So let's see how that turned out. But maybe this will actually be the iPhone moment in the AI industry.
Very interesting. Maybe just one comment, one question, if I may, then just in this relationship, we're hearing so many things. We're not going to go into the details, but maybe it is interesting, at least for me, it is, for listeners to get a feeling for, you know, when should I, listener, then maybe go to this store and when and what do I find there? And maybe when should I go to Bing or to any of the Microsoft products? Is that a thing you can comment on if you want to?
Yeah, I can perhaps just give my, you know, personal opinion.
Right. Okay.
It's not an official statement or anything like that.
Mm-hmm.
But I think, you know, there are a couple of stages. I guess the first stage would be just, you know, trying out this new chat GPT or, you know, chatbot thingy, you know, powered by large language models. I think a good starting point would be the free version of ChatGPT or Bing Chat, right? Bing Chat is also free of charge and it's powered by GPT-4. So then you get a sense on what are a large language model powered chat interface can do or cannot, right? So I think that's a good starting point. And then when you start to look for specific use cases or specific applications to address your certain needs, then I think, you know, the vast majority of use cases will probably be centered around productivity, right? Either maybe helping you to write a new document or, you know, respond to your email or summarize a document, etc. And that can be done, you know, either through the chat interface, ChatGPT or Bing Chat, or you can also use the Copilot from Microsoft. Or you can also go to the GPT store and find a specific specialized GPT, which might, you know, work better for particular data or particular industry. So I think, you know, maybe that's the second step, right? When you are looking more for more specific needs and wants.
Okay, very good. Between those two, and the latter one is then at a cost, right? At least at the moment, right? Which, as an example, I'm doing, you know, $20, I believe, a month, right? Yeah.
Yeah, right. I think you need to have access to ChatGPT Premium to access that. Yeah.
Right. So, and these are then, of course, only the listeners' two options between the originator. I would agree with you. I mean, the technology originated by not necessarily one of those, but the originator, the one that really brought the first product to the consumer. And then, as of course, I believe there's about 500,000, right? Other models, some of other big tech companies like yourself, many open source. But so depending on what it is that you're looking at.
Yeah, absolutely. Maybe just a quick comment on that one. I was more answering from a consumer point of view, right? You know, as an average consumer. But you're absolutely right. In the enterprise space, so much is happening, right? All the tech giants, they're infusing large language model into their product and services. And then you have a whole new wave of startups and scale-ups who are really innovating with large language models.
Right. No, and you answered my specific question on looking at between Microsoft and OpenAI. So that was perfectly okay. So before we then go into the details, dive in, and then we will be looking at, we are going to be concentrating today on use cases. In the beginning, more general, and then moving towards industrial, because this, in the end, is the Industrial AI podcast. So, but let's start our chat with saying, what is actually generative AI? What is Gen AI?
Yeah, so generative AI, as the name tells, it's generative, right? So that means, you know, it's AI models and systems which can generate content. And that content can be text, can be image, can be even, you know, audio, video, in some of the advanced multimodality models. So generative AI, in my head, is a category of applications. But the technology powering generative AI is actually foundation models. And the foundation models are a broader set of advanced AI models, and they serve as the foundation for application and innovation. So within foundation models, you have a category called large language models. So they are focused on natural language understanding and generation, and they're pretty large. So that's what people normally call LLM, large language models.
At least today they are, well, most of them are still pretty large. And maybe when we'll talk a little bit technology, not too detailed, later on as well. And maybe before I forget, one of the things would be this, part of the development, right? So they may not all stay large. I mean, some of them are growing bigger and bigger and bigger. But then other ones are growing smaller and smaller and smaller, right? So, but that's maybe a thing that we'll talk about later. Because maybe you can give us a first idea on, you know, the topic of today is that we're going to learn about the adoption of Gen AI. And, you know, we started talking in, I believe, November, and that's now already 2 months. 2 months gone. I guess in those 2 months, it's almost on a daily basis that we see changes that it's almost impossible. So I'm so much looking forward to learning from you what you can share with us on the adoption of Gen AI. Maybe you can talk a little bit about, you're in charge of Western Europe, but maybe you, I don't know if you have a global view or a European view. What are the different markets? Which are the markets that are really, you know, taking up, and which maybe less? What are the languages? And maybe what is the data that you have to support your claims, so to say?
Yeah. So, Peter, that's like 20 questions in one.
Sure. I always do that.
Yeah. So let's try to unfold, on some of the key topics you mentioned. And please guide me if I, forget something here.
Most certainly.
Yeah. So first on AI adoption, I think, I had the pleasure to talk to many business and technology leaders throughout 2023 about generative AI. And for me, it's also a huge learning process, right? Every company, every industry is different, but we also see some commonalities. So when I talk about AI adoption, I talk mainly from a enterprise point of view, right? So on the consumer side, it might look different. So in the enterprises, in organizations, when they look into adopt generative AI, it comes in multiple stages. It also depends on the maturity of the company. If they have been working with AI in the past on a more classic machine learning, and they have more competence and knowledge, maybe they would, do multiple things at the same time. But for organizations who are relatively new, they normally start by exploring and understanding, what is generative AI, what is large language model. So of course they started by doing training, but they quite often also develop a internal ChatGPT. So basically an internal chatbot powered by a large language model, maybe Azure OpenAI or something else, for their employees to, try out this technology. So then, it basically does the same thing what ChatGPT or Bing Chat does, but it's in a protected internal private and secure environment, for employees to safely explore the technology. So that's quite often the first step. And we see actually many of our customers and partners doing that in the early days of their generative AI adoption. And the second step is when they start to maybe connect this internal, chat interface with their own data. And that's when things get more interesting, right? For example, you can hook up this chat interface with your HR information, with your IT data, and then your employees can actually go to this chatbot, maybe host down your teams or something else, can ask questions about HR, processes or IT policies, etc., without having to navigate, 200 share folders, or internal folders or SharePoint sites, etc., right?
Let's stay here for a sec, if I may, because I was going to ask you later, but now we're at the top of it, and then you can move on with answering my 24 questions. This is so important, because I feel from the beginning that all of us, more so than, as you say, you concentrate on enterprise, the enterprises would love to, and as soon as they understand that that is what they can do, is have, of course, a couple of use cases internally, their own people or their customers, but at least they want to have the models trained, and that's what I'm going to ask you, on their specific information. If it's internal, and that is then the specific thing I'm talking about, is, I want to be very, very careful to have my HR, if it's general information of how to deal, but still, I want to keep it internal. What is today then? Is there one or there several ways to make sure that, number one, if people are just trying things out, that they don't need to be afraid that, I just shared a piece of information and now it's part of the foundation model and the world is going to see it. What is the one or the two different ways that enterprises today can actually do so?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. So I would say twofold. One thing is that you need to distinguish between what is a consumer application and what is an enterprise-ready application, right? So like ChatGPT, Bing Chat, they're developed for the consumers to try out this technology and for personal use. So if you ask questions and provide data from your corporate, and that's leakage, right? And you don't want to do that. So you want to look for enterprise-ready solution. And there are options out there. For example, we also launched Bing Chat Enterprise, which comes with data protection, right? So everything stays within your deployment of Bing Chat. And then I think ChatGPT, they also have announced ChatGPT Enterprise, and it probably also comes with commercial data protection. But like I mentioned, a lot of our customers also choose to develop their own chatbot within their own cloud environment, right? And then it's fully in control by themselves. And they're just, you know, using a large language model, you know, from one of the cloud providers or from open source. But then they have this, you know, chatbot within their own secure private environment. So that's how you safeguard, you know, your corporate data.
So basically you use, if it's, let's say, open source, you take whatever, I don't know. I just want to get a feeling for it. You take the foundation model and then you add your company data to it, and then in such a way that you do it like on premise, you know, it's not that you're doing it, or maybe you are, I don't know. Maybe you are still doing it even in the Azure, in this case, cloud, but that's an only in your section of that cloud, so nobody else can access it, or?
Yeah. So most customers actually do this in the cloud because it's just easier because things are pre-built and configured. And the thing is, you know, most organizations, they don't need to touch the model at all. So there's no fine-tuning, there's no training because the models are pre-trained. And what they do here is basically what we call RAG, retrieval augmented.
RAG is the big acronym of 2023. It's even going to be bigger in 2024.
Yeah.
Explain definitely. Us what is RAG.
Yeah, so it's a pattern to combine a generic large language model with specific data set. So if you think about the capabilities that comes from model, you know, a couple of things, you know, the model understand, you know, content and text, and then the model can also generate the content and text. So if we talk from a text point of view, the model has linguistic capability and the model has some reasoning capability and the model has some knowledge from the training data. But the training data might be outdated and also might contain bias, you know, because the internet is biased, you know, by default. So what you want to do is to, you know, ask the model to reason over your own data. So basically you can provide a set of documents or you can point the model to a database that you have internally where you have, you know, verified knowledge as a source. And then when the model, you know, derive an answer to your question, you will actually look into the data. Think about having a new employee, you give them a manual, right? And then when you ask them a question, they would look up the manual first, and then they synthesize and distill the information into a concise answer to you. And that's essentially what happens in RAG. The large language model would look into the documents and database that you provided, and then you know find the right section and right part of that document, and then summarize and then return to you in a concise natural language manner.
Right, that's what it stands for, retrieval augmented generation, I believe, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Good. Stay with the example of the HR internal. One question then is, so if HR decides they're going to do this, and then one HR employee takes the 1,000 documents they have, it doesn't matter the number, so they do one time RAG, and then from the next time on, if then employees are asking questions, do they all the time, each time, need to provide that that RAG information as well? Or is it only like a single time and then so the HR team knows, okay, now the model knows all there is to know about our company HR policy?
I think this depends on, you know, how the RAG pattern is implemented at the organization. And to be honest, I'm not a, you know, technical expert on RAG myself either. But I think, you know, you have the opportunity to, for example, every time you ask the question to a model, you provide specific documents. You can do that. So that's on an ad hoc basis. But you can also more advanced RAG where you connect a large language model with embeddings, with vector storage. And so that's where you can probably, you know, have some documents or internal knowledge pre-processed that maybe even, what's that word, maybe even sustain that, you know, for multiple sessions, multiple conversations. But this part need to be verified by technical architect,
sure,
right?
Sure, that's okay. Okay, so we talked about business leaders, enterprise. One second thing I was going to ask, machine learning you mentioned, are we still going to have the original machine learning from the last 2 years, or is everything going to be large language models?
Oh, absolutely, yes. So large language model is not going to be the answer to everything.
Not the only one, okay.
yeah, it's like the hottest topic right now. It's the buzzing topic, but it's not the answer to everything. If you think about some of the use cases like anomaly detection or demand forecast, and or you know some of the use cases related to computer vision, I think many of the use cases would benefit from a much smaller, you know, much more performant and efficient model than a large language model, right? So I think, you know, what we encourage our, you know, customers to do is to start by understanding your needs and your challenges in your business, and then identify the use cases. And then we can talk about, you know, what's the technology, what's the model that you should use.
I recall, and it was not just on the Microsoft platform. I think the other providers, if they're AWS, Google, all the other ones, do a similar approach and take you by the hand. And this taking by the hand was happening already when I was looking maybe like 4 years ago, you know, 4 or 5 years ago, at the beginning when things were opening up. And you would take, you know, customers by the hand and say what it is you want to do. I recall exactly in a PowerPoint slide that I was looking at. And then below it are all the different algorithms, which some of the listeners know and use them, and other ones do not need to, but they just learn to understand what it is they can do. So, okay, let's look into that, because, you know, we're just talking a lot about language models all the time in the industrial environment. And of course, as you say, we've been using other types of algorithms in the past. And I do believe that, you know, that some of our listeners are working on, you know, can we use large language models also to do like e.g. predictive maintenance? And if that's then in the end the right thing to do or not, we'll find out. But maybe it's a combination. So I interrupted you with, you know, you were explaining, you know, what it is that you have learned. Where is the adoption of Gen AI?
Yeah, so I put things into four stages when it comes to generative AI adoption. I think I talked about the first two already. The first one is basically try out the technology with the internal chatbot, you know, internal version of ChatGPT, if you like. And the second is when you start to do RAG, right? You start to connect that chatbot with your internal data, internal knowledge. And to be honest, just maybe to add a few words on that, you know, when we say retrieval augmented generation, it starts with the retrieval. You're basically retrieving information internally, but instead of doing the more word matching search, you're actually doing conversational search, right? You're asking questions, and then the large language model help you analyze, retrieve, and then summarize information. So that's the first two, you know, stages. And then after that, you know, organizations normally have built up some confidence and some knowledge around using large language models. They start to look into more use cases. And the third stage, we see quite often, you know, organizations start to identify some internal use cases related to different business processes that they can perhaps, you know, optimize or automate. You know, one example could be looking into automatic processing of internal documents, everything from, you know, invoices to, you know, accounting documents and stuff like that. And we see customers, you know, implementing large language models in maybe the finance or accounting department or after sales department to automatically handle claims and invoices, etc. And this is where, you know, large language model will be combined quite often with a OCR solution or a document intelligence solution. But then in that case, you can not only extract key information from the right documents, you can even chat, you know, and then summarize, you know, the documents. So I think that's essentially document intelligence on steroids with large language model, if you like. And that's, you know, about automatic processing of different documents. And then we also see, you know, depending on the industry, organizations using, you know, large language models, maybe for log analysis, right? We have worked with a security solution provider, and they have the log from different, you know, physical equipments they have. And they used to spend like, you know, maybe hundreds of hours, you know, by human beings reviewing the log manually. And now they actually use GPT-4 to analyze that within a matter of minutes and seconds. And then, of course, the model can help you flag where you as a human need to maybe double click and, you know, verify. But it does the sort of the groundwork for you. So I think that's also a good example. And the last one maybe I want to mention is like anomaly detection, right? You can do that absolutely with a more classic, smaller machine learning model. But what we see, you know, some of the organizations within the finance sector doing is they also now develop a natural language interface, and then empowered by large language model, by the way, and then they can actually ask questions, you know, to this natural language interface, this chatbot, which then helps the financial analyst to comb through vast amount of financial documents and then maybe finding the right signals and then surface back to them in a concise manner. And basically, you know, telling them, hey, maybe you need to double click on this particular document because it's marked as high risk based on the analysis.
I believe that that's exactly where a lot of research is going on. And we, Robert and I, have heard that maybe, you know, time series, which is the type of data we have in industrial environment, are difficult or maybe difficult to consume for large language models. I'm not sure. Maybe somebody's going to find a solution. But in the end, at least, I would also assume that the large language model is going to at least be the user interface, so the human interface towards the data, where in the past it has been, you know, some kind of algorithm finding patterns, positive, negative, in this case, you know, finding the anomalies, but putting the large language models in front of it, you know, asking or and then put it the other way around, making it preventive. So the algorithm, the application coming back to the human and saying, oh, something is going to happen there, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And I personally envision more and more use cases going forward will be enabled by a combination of multiple AI models. And like you said, you know, the large language model might reside more on the user side, right? Because it's more about making the interaction between a system and a user intuitive and simple, right? Through natural language. But then, you know, deeper down, maybe you have other models specifically for, I don't know, demand forecasting or analyzing seismic data. So that's the model running there doing that specific thing. But on the surface, you have the large language model orchestrating maybe multiple deeper models, you know, more specialized models, and then also handling the interaction between the backend system and the front end and user interaction.
Okay, so thanks for this introduction into your view on the different steps. Let's move into a couple of use cases, because there is this topic which is close to my heart, is too strongly said, but it's an important topic, and it has all to do with RAG, and RAG has all to do with the human interface. And my feeling is that, you know, and I consuming, as most listeners know, most of, you know, whatever I learn is through LinkedIn, and what's happening on LinkedIn on a day-to-day basis, which, you know, specifically to the development of the large language models, is so strongly around, I would say, the front end, and that's what we just talked about, of communicating with the large language models. And RAG is the big thing, and I think that's in itself perfect. I'm just only asking the general question is, like, should the providers and of the large language models, of which is one, you know, OpenAI, Microsoft, and all the other ones, should the developers not, you know, learn by what it is they and all the other people around are developing on the front end side, and not try to put it in the back end? What I mean is, couldn't we as humans not expect, you know, the large language models to learn the way that is that we want to communicate, rather than that we need to, you know, learn prompting, learn RAG, learn to do ABC, etc.? Do you have a view on that? Do you have a view on where that is going?
First, I want to just distinguish RAG and prompting, right? Because, you know, RAG is about providing additional knowledge to the model. And maybe in the future, I don't know, with things like Neuralink, you can, you know, help a large language model tap into your...
I'm not sure I want to do that, but okay.
Yeah, exactly. I'm just saying that, you know, maybe that's an alternative in tapping into your human knowledge. But right now, a lot of knowledge resides in documents or databases, especially company-specific knowledge and data, right? So if you want the model to focus on that, then you need to connect the model with your prescribed source of knowledge. And that's essentially what we do with RAG. But to your question on prompting, it's such a new domain. And, you know, prompt engineering is also rising as a very exciting discipline. It has got a lot of attention. And there are people who, you know, claim to be professional prompt engineers already on LinkedIn, right? And people have so many different titles on LinkedIn. Anyway, but to your point on if we want large language models or foundation models in general to adapt to how we communicate as humans and not caring so much about prompting, I think that's going to happen. Because right now, when we leverage large language models for specific use cases, especially if you're asking, let's say, a model to generate an image of certain style, of certain, you know, artistic style, certain lighting, etc., you have to be quite specific on describing the desired image you want the model to generate. And that's where we already start to see a distinction. Like, I don't want to, you know, advertise OpenAI models. They're a close partner. But if you think about Midjourney, their models are super strong and they create, you know, realistic and stunning photos and images. But to prompt the Midjourney model, you have to follow certain format and you have to be very concise, and it's not really natural language. You're basically using a lot of the comma and use a lot of keyword. But if you do that with the DALL-E 3, for example, the latest tech to image model from OpenAI, you can actually just use natural language, right? So there you already start to see the difference.
Oh, that's my point. Well, yeah, very good, very good, very good. And the thing I'm hearing is, or what my brain is kind of hearing, as I like to say, by listening to you, is like it has to do a lot with, almost like with culture as well. You know, I'm from the Netherlands. I live in Germany. You know, you need a certain time to find out the way the people, you know, you were born, I don't know, you studied in Delft, now live in Oslo. I have a Swedish friend. I go to the United States already on that level because there was this person from OpenAI. I think it was a person called Kilpatrick, I believe. And he was saying, you know, yeah, you know, prompting is not going to be the big thing. And I said, oh, you know, it's already been Christmas because that's exactly what I was expecting as well. But he talks about reading, writing, and listening. Are those the three, which almost sound like, you know, human skills? Are we going to, you know, better communicate as humans as well? But you gave a good example, I believe. And my strong feeling is that if the large language are going to be there for all of us, then, you know, it is the way that the large language is going to react to our question, to the thing that is that we want, that, you know, maybe it should trigger this kind of interactive way of doing things rather than, and I think that today we have prompt engineers perfectly fine. I cannot imagine that is going to be, and those of you, dear listeners who are, don't take it personal, but that's going to be an activity that we're going to still have, you know, a year or two from now. My belief is that, that the provider of the LLM that is going to bring the solution that is there for all of us to interact is going to be the one that humans are going to choose, is my strong belief.
Yeah, and Peter, maybe just to add a bit color to that, I think one thing is maybe about the intrinsic capability of the model itself and how it handles input in natural language. Like we talk about the difference between Midjourney and DALL-E 3. But the other thing would also be what we call meta prompt. So basically, when an organization, you know, builds a solution with a large language model, of course, the user will be prompting, you know, when they use the application. But you can also have some, you know, system message or meta prompt hidden behind the scene, right? That's basically the context you're providing to the model as the developer. And you can maybe tell the model to behave in any under any circumstances, behave as a customer service agent or only answer questions related to IT, right? And that's the type of messages you can, you know, store behind the scene. And it doesn't matter how the user prompt, and this will be additional context added to the user's prompt. So that's what we call meta prompt. And that's another technique that can be used.
Or then the store that, you know, has just opened. And then, yeah, you're going to say, you know, this is, you know, ask Robert, for example. Then, you know, Robert is going to, and that's what Sam showed 2 months ago, right? You know,
yeah.
He is a specialist in what? In company development, whatever it is. You load your information.
Exactly.
And then you give it to somebody else. And you say, okay, this is the Peter GPT. If you want to, you know, be consulted by Peter, ask the Peter GPT. Very good.
That's an excellent example, by the way.
So give us the first example. Share with us, please, Xiaopeng, the first example of a use case where you've run into.
Yeah, I think, you know, maybe just to carry on the adoption journey, I talk about the third space now, you know, where customers identify internal business processes and infuse AI into that. And one of the areas that I forgot to mention is really in the contact center space. So a lot of, you know, large telcos or, you know, insurance companies and many other industries, they run large contact centers. And that's also where we see a lot of, you know, use cases being powered by AI, you know, from having a 24/7 available, actually intelligent chatbot powered by large language model that can actually, you know, have natural language conversation with the customers. That's clearly one use case. A lot of organizations are now replacing their, if I dare to say, dumb bots with large language model powered chatbots. And also within the contact center, you can also use large language models to help the agents, the human agents, to summarize the conversation between them and the customers, or even analyze the core transcriptions and to discover insights for, you know, product planning, campaign planning, etc. And the last part, stage four, is where things become quite interesting. I'm personally super excited about this stage. It's where, you know, we start to see organizations start to combine their industry expertise with large language model and start to build industry-specific copilots. I mean, copilot is the term that we started to use for Microsoft, but now it's also adopted by, you know, different organizations out there. Essentially, it's a AI-powered virtual assistant that can help humans to perform certain tasks. And let me just, you know, mention a couple examples. So we have been working with a Swedish fashion retailer called Lindex. And they have actually built a Lindex Copilot, which is based on Azure OpenAI, but combined with their knowledge and data about store operations. So now every time they onboard a new employee or they train a new employee, you know, they don't always have to have a more senior employee, you know, following them and giving them instructions on a daily basis. The employee can actually talk to Lindex Copilot on a tablet or a mobile application. And then based on which store you are in and based on your profile and preference, you will give you personalized, you know, answers and, you know, tips managing the store, right? Everything from maybe setting up the different products within the store and maybe checking on inventory and maybe, you know, having guidance on how to have a pleasant conversation with the customer. And those are things that you can actually consult and get advice from this Lindex Copilot. I found that really interesting because it's really about making the employees in the store more confident and more knowledgeable so they can be at their best when serving the customers. And that eventually would bring better customer experience.
Very good.
Yeah, so this is in the retail space. And another example I want to mention is a Icelandic startup. It's called Lucinity. And, you know, they have been building software solutions for anti-money laundry for quite some time. And in 2023, we have started working together and they looked into including the GPT models into their solution. And they launched something called Lucy. And that's the name of their AI copilot for anti-money laundry. And so essentially, instead of having the anti-money laundry specialist reviewing all the documents manually, because that's actually what they do nowadays in the industry, they can have large language model, you know, help them browse through vast amount of documents and highlight where there are potential risks and red flags. And then the financial analyst or crime investigator can actually then look into specific documents and sort of information to identify risks around anti-money laundry. So I think this is an example where you can use a large language model to enhance the efficiency in processing information, but also acting as a natural language interface between you and the task that you are performing behind the systems.
Very good. What do we have in the industrial space?
In the industrial space, you know, examples start to appear in the past couple of months. And I think since we got in touch on LinkedIn, there have been quite a few new examples. And that's super exciting. One thing I want to mention is particularly from the automotive space. I think, Peter, you're based in Germany, right?
Yep, exactly.
Yes. So you probably have seen an example of Mercedes already, right? They have enhanced their in-car voice assistant with the ChatGPT model on Azure. And now the drivers can have a truly natural language conversation with the in-car voice assistant. And then, you know, the assistant can perform multiple tasks. And a similar example is from TomTom. And they have also, you know, announced this collaboration with us. And we're actually together at CES nowadays demonstrating.
All right. Yeah.
yeah, the new in-car voice assistant from TomTom. And the difference here is that TomTom, they build a platform. So they have a digital cockpit, you know, infused with generative AI, and then they can provide this solution to other car manufacturers for them to incorporate. So this is in the automotive space. And also in the manufacturing space, as a heavy industry, we also have seen some really exciting examples. One is Siemens. You know, we have also announced the partnership with them, and we have a similar partnership with ABB as well, where we're looking into bringing the power of generative AI into the industrial software that Siemens and ABB are building, respectively, of course. And so that's everything from predictive maintenance to anomaly detection to quality management, etc. And also, you know, maybe also analyzing IT and OT data, right, from the different systems, engineering systems and industry equipments that they are operating.
Yes, Robert will actually be doing an interview in these days with Boris Scheringer from Siemens and the representative from Schaeffler on exactly this topic of the Siemens Industrial Copilot. So we're going to hear more in detail about that one. Also heard about Volkswagen this week, by the way, on CES as well.
Yes.
That's where then typically maybe one more technical, and then we probably need to come to a close at some point, is then certain people are then afraid of the hallucinations. How do you see hallucinations being, you know, brought down to zero if possible? You know, especially in a car, you know, depending on, maybe you limit the kind of questions or you limit the kind of answers. I don't know how that is, kind of thing. And in a car is one thing, is driving a car or driving, so to say, a production line is very similar, you know, where there's robots and heavy gear and everything. How do we make sure that the potential of the hallucinations with the solution that we use in that kind of environment is going to be, you know, limited or possibly, you know, being brought down to zero?
Yeah. So, I mean, first, hallucination is an intrinsic challenge within large language models, right? No large language model is free from that. But there are effective techniques for mitigating that. And I think we actually touched upon, you know, two of those already. The first one is really around prompt engineering and specifically meta prompting. So basically, you can set, you know, guardrails around the model already and ask the model to maybe focus on certain topics and avoid answer certain questions. So that's one way. So maybe you know what the model, maybe you have higher confidence of the model answering questions for certain topics. So you focus on that. So that's from meta prompting. But the other one, which we see even more use, is actually RAG, right? Because that's where instead of asking the model to answer based on its training data or based on the open internet or based on what the model might make up, which is hallucination, you ask the model to answer based on prescribed source of data and information, right? So that's where you provide specific set of verified, assured documents or database for the model to derive answer from. And that's probably by far the most effective technique for mitigating hallucination. Maybe on this one, I just want to make mention one example. Also in the industrial space, it's a company called Cognite. So it's based out of Norway, Oslo actually. So they have been building data platform for asset heavy industry. They started within the energy space, but they're also expanding into other industries verticals. So they have also launched a AI copilot together with us for industrial data. So before adopting GenAI, they have already built a data platform for contextualization, really bridging the data from OT systems to IT systems. And now they basically build a new natural language interface on top of data platform, so the data analyst and the business analyst can actually access data, analyze data in a much more intuitive manner. And one thing they have done to mitigate hallucination is to build up internal what they call industry knowledge graph. And that's essentially their way of building a brain of verified and assured knowledge from OT and IT systems. And then they use that in a RAG deployment with a large language model. And then that combination makes their solutions, you know, I would say hallucin free, but, you know, I haven't tried firsthand, but, you know, that's at least their ambition.
I looked into Cognite. I may contact them. Very interesting. What I can say is my feeling is of the solution you are suggesting, you know, as RAC as the top level is from my perspective, and most listeners probably actually haven't heard of it, you know. I mean, it all started in the 1950s, 60s, and later on it was called symbolic AI, right? And we had our AI winters and everything, and we still have, you know, a handful, or should I say hundreds, thousands, don't take it personal, people who have for their lifetime been looking at this symbolic AI. And then came machine learning, then called subsymbolic. And in the end, it's the combination of those two worlds of defining, categorizing, for as an example, through knowledge graphs, the world, and then take your subsymbolic machine learning, transformer, large language models, and ask them to go into your kind of organized world. And then, yes, I would agree that you can theoretically then can get answers that are, you know, 100% within the space that you have provided, that you have trained your model with, right?
Yeah, and the last thing I might add is that depending on how mission critical the use case and application is, you need to really assure that humans are in the loop, right? So there might be, you know, business processes of low risk and that you can, you know, trust the AI system to handle independently. But there are, you know, use cases where you want to have human to review the recommendation, to govern the decision from the AI systems before you actually put that into use.
Very good. Chopeng, final question. If you have, please share with us a view on the status of Gen AI in different parts of the world, US, China, Asia, Europe, and how is Gen AI going to change, you know, going to change the world of, you know, specifically for us here in this world of the industrial AI?
I think before the explosive development, if I can say, around generative AI, there has already been a quite well acknowledged view out there that, you know, US and China are leading in the AI space and Europe has been lagging a bit behind. And you know, for different reasons. I mean, for US, they have, you know, accumulated strong competence from research development, and also they are also in a more favorable regulatory environment. Similarly in China, when it comes to regulation, but also in China, a lot of the consumer tech giants, they have, you know, access to a huge amount of data, which helps them train massive and powerful AI models, especially for the consumer space. But now with generative AI, I think, you know, it's too early to say, but there are a couple of things which will definitely decide if the landscape will be changed or will remain. One thing is the fact that, you know, most of the use cases will be powered by pre-trained models. So that means, you know, not every organization needs to train their own model, right? You have large language models or smaller language models, you know, provided by tech giants or specialized model developers. And there is an opportunity for European organizations to accelerate on the application of the models, right? Like, I mean, of course, there are very interesting, exciting players like Mistral out of Europe building, you know, large language models, foundation models as well. But the vast majority of European organizations, they don't have to build a model. They can just focus on creating value and accelerate adoption and creating application, innovative applications, right, for European organizations or even for the globe. So I think, you know, maybe we can look at, you know, the comparison between AI development across the three regions, not only from a AI development point of view, but also from an AI, applied AI, you know, application point of view. And that might give a slightly different landscape.
Sounds great to me, and I tend to agree. And in the end, sure, I mean, this differentiation is very useful, but in the end, for us, for the listeners, for the industrial space, I think in the end, the use cases, the applications are going to be built on the vast amount of knowledge capabilities of 100 years, 100 and more years of industrial production. And that knowledge is, you know, needs to somehow be put into, in this case, industrial knowledge. And I think you've been giving us examples of how that can be done, and also that that it will be done actually. So, Chaopeng.
Yeah, can I maybe just add to that, Peter, just quickly? I just want to say that, you know, Europe is, you know, has a long history. And like you said, especially in some of the industrial space, like manufacturing, automotive, and also, in financial sector, it has been leading, you know, for many years. And the accumulated knowledge and expertise will play a key role in AI application, because many of the examples we talked about need organizations to combine a generic large language model with industry expertise, right? So that's where, you know, European organization will definitely shine. So maybe in my head, actually, we should expect to see even more industry-specific co-pilots, you know, coming out of Europe based on the accumulated knowledge.
That's what I expect as well. That's up to you, dear listeners, to make them, to produce them, right? So, Chaopeng, thank you very much. Listeners that maybe want to get in touch with you, they can do so. You suggested by LinkedIn. Chaopeng Li is with an X, IAOPENG, and then Li like LI. Otherwise, if you, dear listeners, have any questions, comments, as always, please send a short email to peter@aipod.de. I'm very happy that you stay with us so far. Looking forward to have you with us again. And Chaopeng, thank you very much. And I'm going to try to say have a good day in your language. Ha en fin dag.
That's impressive. You speak much better Norwegian than I do. But thank you so much, Peter, for having me. It's a pleasure.
Thank you very much. Have a good day. Bye-bye.
Take care. Bye-bye.